It's Thursday, October 31st, 2013, and welcome to episode 158 of Tech Talk for Teachers. I'm Tom Grissom.
I'm Cindy Rich.
I'm Mike Joya.
Welcome to the Halloween edition of Tech Talk for Teachers. Coming up, we're going to be talking about MOOCs, M-O-O-Cs. We'll be talking about massive open online courses. We'll have our security spotlight. Mike, you'll be talking about a couple of different things.
Yep, scary stuff. Losing everything through encryption.
It is really scary this time, so you want to be sure to check that one out. And then, Cindy, what do you have?
Talk about change and some changes I've had to make with my personal settings with the changes that came from Google.
We'll have a RIP section.
That's right. We are having a Halloween.
We are. So sit back, relax, and here we go. This month at Eastern Illinois University, we have a science and technology symposium currently going on, and I recently gave a talk about tablets and the cloud and how it's currently changing education, and kind of one of the themes is revolutions in technology and science. So, Cindy, I know you have one coming up.
I'm going to be presenting on technology and science resources on the Library of Congress website and some of the different things that they can find, whether it's, there are some very high-tech level materials on there and information in the congressional records, things like that. And then all the way back to just Alexander Graham Bell, Wright Brothers, and some of famous inventors, Thomas Jefferson, their notes and personal notes for the different things they've invented and created and the process of invention. And so there's a whole variety of things that people can find.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is the one of, we hope, future science and technology symposiums going on. And it's really nice because we have experts from all across campus coming in, special speakers. The kickoff was on nanotechnology, so yeah. I happened to go to that. And that one was very interesting. We had a person from Penn State come in and do a presentation on that. But one of the things that I was tying, revolutions in science and technology and with the tablet computing and cloud computing, obviously just skyrocketing and taking off. The other trend, which was really hot last year, it picked up a lot of momentum, was something called MOOCs, M-O-O-C.
Right. We're seeing more about that all the time.
And that stands for Massive Open Online Courses. And there are several initiatives out there, and I'll put a link in the show notes. I've got an infographic out here.
They were pretty confident to name it Massive right off.
Well, what makes it,
Define massive.
Yeah.
Well, many of these 100,000 plus students are signing up.
They truly are massive.
Yes. And there are currently three big ones out there. There's edX, Coursera, and Udacity. Mm-hmm. And these are courses out there offered by, top-tier university, MIT, Stanford, Berkeley, Harvard. They're all starting this initiative, as the name implies. Massive Open means that anybody can register for it. And then the online component with the advances in broadband, internet, and video, instruction. They're really building those courses out. But in this infographic, 74% of universities now offer a MOOC type format course. So as I said, they're really starting to pick up steam. I will provide some links. One of the reasons that this is occurring, as I said, is because of the bandwidth and the miniaturization with the tablets. And we're really going into this era of personalized learning. So there's several things that are tied together with this. And one of them is learning analytics. I know we have a lot of interest with kind of keeping track of what's kind of been termed as big data. If we collect all this information and have everything online, I think we've mentioned here before, like the Khan Academy, they have like 3-4 million students out there every month going through and looking at those different courses.
So, but that's not considered, is that a MOOC?
I would think that in some cases, in some instances, that's one of the problems. It's such a fuzzy definition. Mm-hmm. It's like, how do you define that? And because it is new and a revolution, we're working through a lot of different issues. The massive component of it, just registration.
Sure.
It's like, you know, you were kidding just a little bit ago about MIT. It's like, well, I just took a course from MIT.
Right.
I'm a graduate of MIT now. I have this course.
I got this course.
Yeah.
Accepted.
Their alumni office will be contacting you.
Yep. For me.
So, I mean, how do you handle the credentials or certificates and things? And most of these are, you know, most of these are free. There's no cost
sign
up.
That was my next question. Okay.
But if you want to be registered officially and have course credit, many of them offer, I mean, that's the only way that they can really make money.
Right.
You have to sign up and go through their official process. And
I think some of those are at the end of the class, which I can see the advantage there, like especially if you're a non-traditional student or an adult. And you're trying to get back into learning a new skill set because maybe your skill set is becoming obsolete. Right. You can try this out, and then we get busy. We can't be a full-time student and go to campus.
Well, that's their number one target, demographic out there, because everybody's busy taking, doing normal life things.
Yeah, and you can try to take it, and then if you get halfway through it and time just doesn't permit, you're not really out any money.
Right.
But then again, you don't get any advantage towards taking it.
Right. And this kind of leads into a whole nother thing that's currently going on. There's a big movement with badges, and certifying, certifying learning. So all of these things have yet to be worked out. But yeah, that's definitely the target audience. And as you say, you can try something. You're not really out anything with it. But some of the completion rates, and I'll put some links in the show notes for that as well, but are really pretty poor. I mean, I've seen statistics out there, 10,000 students taking a course and like 200 will complete it.
But I wonder if employers start acknowledging that on resumes and things like that and valuing that. If that starts happening, then I imagine we'll see more changes as they become more valuable and people completing them and wanting those certifications or badges or whatever.
But it may go the opposite way, too, that employers might find it as...
Right, not take it seriously.
As seriously as if someone did go to a regular program.
Very true. Right.
They may not.
Well, computer science majors have really kind of led this, over the years, because we have credentials. You go through and you're CompTIA certified or whatever, whatever it is. And those mean something to the industry. So those are, I hesitate to use the word badges. Certificates is really what they are. But you have to go through the process and be certified that, you're competent in this area. Whereas some of the others, one of the original founders, I think Sebastian Thrun, I believe, from Stanford, he was he's one of the persons that started Udacity. And I think they advertised last year they had like 160,000 students. And I think I'm looking down through here on some of the stats and things, but they hope to have like 500,000, students here. So, I mean, they're on pace to do that. But right now it's venture fund, capital being funded for this. So,
well, and there's the commercial out now that's what I believe Bank of America and Khan Academy. And they were talking about how, Bank of America came to them and said, oh, we want to be able to do this. And they said, well, we're already doing it.
Right.
That's a perfect combination. And that connects with what we were talking about with the symposium going on here, that, the diversity of what's being offered, and that in whether it's finance, computer skills, in almost anything where you've got continuing professional development, I would think if it's not hands-on, it's something that could be done online.
Yeah. Yeah. I will tell a personal story back a long time ago when I was in college. We had something similar. University of Illinois had the Plato system they were developing. I don't know if you've heard of that one before, but they actually had some chemistry courses available online, and you literally learned from this computer terminal at the time. It was pretty advanced for the time. You had touchscreen and things, but it was very much programmed instruction. And that's kind of the model where a lot of these things are going through, because at some point you kind of have to have a test for understanding, going through, and at what point do you do that. A lot of critics say, well, there's no social interaction. But if you go out, and again, I'll provide the links and look at some of the sites, there are a lot of forums out there, and you find people kind of forming ad hoc study groups and things like that. So it is possible to have that, personal social interaction.
Well, at some major universities, you can be in a lecture class of hundreds of people that there's not a whole lot of personal interaction in
that
either.
Right. So it's one of those things, like I said, it's one of those things that I think you'll start seeing more of. At the K-12 level, there's a lot of virtual schools going on. I know here in Illinois, we've had an Illinois virtual high school for going on 10 plus years now, where high school students can go out and take courses online, and there's some support and things out there, and you know, other states have that as well. And I'm starting to see that go down into the middle school as well. So as the technology improves, as things, and one of the other things I think that really makes this more viable than it has been in the past, the prices on these devices keep going down, and they're more capable. And that key piece is the bandwidth, mm-hmm. which kind of reminds me, sometime this week, a couple days ago, last time on our Tech Talk for Teachers episode, I think we talked about EdChats.
We did.
And there was an EdChat going on this week with Arne Duncan, who is the Secretary of Education for the federal government, right. U.S. Department of Education. And he was actually on Twitter and participated in one of those Twitter EdChats. And he was kind of asking, you know, okay, teachers, how do you use this? And, you know, for the most part, it was positive. You know, there obviously were some negative comments out there as well. But it was kind of neat to be able to have the opportunity to go out and either pose a question. And I know one of the things that I mentioned whenever I directed a question to him was the issue of bandwidth, particularly here in rural Illinois. You know, we're blessed here at Eastern because we have this massive pipe out there and high-speed bandwidth.
Right.
But that is certainly not true in the surrounding communities. So if you're a K-12 teacher wanting to flip your classroom and you assign, you know, your students the homework, you can't guarantee that when they go home that, you know, they're going to have affordable, broadband access at home. So that's currently a limitation here. So that's, online learning, obviously, continuing to grow. And as the technology improves, I think we'll start seeing more. Okay, as usual, it's time for our security spotlight, and a lot of different things are going on this month. I just caught on a Washington Post article about the NSA surveillance and being able to tap into Google and Yahoo's main feeds. So I'll provide a link out in the show notes about that. So all kinds of revelations going on about the NSA. But there's also a lot of hacking still going on out there. And Mike, I'll just turn it over here. I'll let you pick your topic here because there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, I have a couple topics. And like you said right before we got started here, that Adobe bumped up to about 30 million users now as opposed to the 2.8 or 9.
Yeah, 2.9 I think we said last time. Yeah, so
that they released. So that's
compromised accounts, not good.
Yeah, that's a bit higher, you would say, than
yes.
It previously was. And then Buffer, which is an app that lets you send out automated tweets or and Facebook posts, they got compromised. The was it Monday?
Yeah, it was earlier this week. Earlier this week.
They had some downtime. They were actually stopped their services and actually hid the posts and stuff to get things fixed up. And then eventually once they got Facebook online first, and then a couple hours later they were able to get Twitter back online and then resume normal operations in the evening time frame where people could, you know, submit instantly what they wanted to submit. And it wasn't being hidden until they got things cleaned
up. So did the average user out there even know that happened, or was that all kind of taken behind the scenes?
I think they didn't know it happened, except that there was some spam messages that went out, some like weight loss spam message that went out under people's posts, and it didn't affect everyone that had the app, and some people didn't even notice. Actually, Buffer was on top of it pretty fast, I think. And actually, we're issuing apologies before, I think.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you suspect something like that happens, always the first reaction is go out and change your password. But it wasn't necessarily that they had the password in that particular case.
And the other part is that could have been scary is the fact that this app actually passes a token to your Facebook and Twitter account so that when it submits. So you would normally put in your username and password into Facebook and Twitter to log in and then do your posts. Well, this app, in theory, does the same thing, but it does it through a token, which is an approved little token that allows the app to authorize.
Yeah,
into the app. And luckily, they had been encrypting their tokens. So therefore, people didn't have, they weren't able to get into the person's Facebook or Twitter account, just the Buffer account. So they couldn't get in there and compromise Twitter and Facebook on top of the Buffer app.
Yeah. And we're hearing a lot of that with the news about the NSA and things. We're hearing that word encrypted, and probably the average user, you know, what does that mean? You know, just in very basic terms, what does encryption mean?
Encryption means that you take your information, if it was like a number, and they apply a very complex math algorithm, almost like a formula, to that, which then generates another, let's say, if we're talking straight numbers, another number that is gibberish, basically, to everyone else. It wouldn't look right. It's incorrect. And then on the other end of wherever you're sending your encrypted message to, it has the ability to reverse it. It knows the algorithm and reverses it back so that the other program actually sees exactly what you're doing.
But so if somebody was tapped into a line and trying to see that traffic, they wouldn't see.
It'd just be all wingdings back in the past. It'd just be gibberish to them. They wouldn't understand. And that's what a VPN, which I've talked about in the past here, does. It actually encrypts your data stream from your computer to a server that you're paying, you know, usually you pay for. So if anyone's in the middle, all they see is gibberish. You know, and then, of course, the NSA has ways to decrypt that and re-encrypt it, which they've already said.
Yeah, those are called keys, right?
It depends what type of encryption, if they have the certain key to do it, or they know the algorithm to use.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, this is always an arms race whenever you try coming up with a system. Somebody tries to come up with a system to beat it and things, but it's been in the news a lot lately. Yeah.
And that's the other thing. Like, encryption standards from 10 years ago, they're not even useful anymore because the common person can unencrypt them in midstream. So they don't even recommend you use the old encryption.
Right.
And I think the government and NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, actually have a competition out right now to develop the new algorithm for encryption to make it more powerful. And they give a pretty good size amount of money for someone if they select their encryption method for that. And that's how those usually come from. Okay. And speaking more on encryption, it's actually being used as a malware device or a ransomware device.
Yeah, that was out this week too.
Is it's called a CryptoLocker malware. And basically what it is, it's like ransomware. And some people may have seen that the previous ransomware from the FBI or the NSA, and it gets on your computer and you can't do anything except click a link and pay them money if you want your information back. Well, those you can use antivirus and stuff and malware bytes as an example to remove that, and so that you don't actually have to pay any money. That one's more of a threat. They're saying you're going to be arrested unless you pay money. But CryptoLocker gets you is that it's the same idea, except it encrypts your hard drive. And if you have a certain amount of time to pay money, and if you don't do it, they throw the key away, the encryption key, and then you can never get your information back. And there's no antivirus to
translate it back.
To remove it from your computer because it's encrypted, and you don't have the key for that. Dang. So the way to, if you do get it, to remove it is to reformat your whole hard drive.
So you've lost everything.
So how do you get something like that?
The CryptoLocker has been, right now, they say it's coming in as an email attachment, an attachment in an email, usually under the impression it's from UPS or FedEx saying you have a package to be delivered. But it just comes in and says, you know, open up this PDF file. And that's how it's appearing as a PDF file with a hidden executable file or .exe at the end. Gotcha. Of the file name. So you got to hover over and make sure what you're clicking on. Just because it looks like a PDF picture on the front doesn't necessarily mean that's a PDF picture that you're opening. And then it goes in and encrypts everything.
I was going to say, would just the average person like me have to worry about something like that? Is that more towards business, finance, computer?
Oh, it's anybody.
Just anybody.
It's blanketed. I mean, like any type of malware, if you get like 1% of the people to fall for it, you know, they're making their money that way.
It's so
they're
going $300 to get your stuff unencrypted, but you have to put in a credit card or some type of some type of electronic
payment.
And
since they're trying to do something destructive anyway, there's no guarantee that you pay the $300, you're going to get your
Or it's not going to be $3,000.
Right. Well, most say that they'll actually decrypt your information if you do pay, but then you just gave some criminal
your credit card
number.
Well, okay, and on that too, step it down from your level a little bit for you two. Say, for example, so a conversation we had at my house recently. There was a thing on Facebook to vote for our football coach. And to, you know, for coaches, I don't know if it was coach of the year or what. But when you did it, you had to give them access to all of your Facebook friends and this and that and the other. And we were talking about why would they need that? And, you know, that's when you started thinking, okay, this isn't a legitimate contest. This is a promotion and advertisement somebody is doing. But is that something you should be leery of doing, or is it one of those that things like that are probably just fine and you can...
It's whatever you're personally comfortable with.
That'd throw up a yellow flag for me.
I wouldn't be comfortable if my friends on Facebook were giving my information to Allstate Nationwide. I can't, it's either Allstate or Nationwide.
Right.
To start spamming me with...
Right, because it's messages. That targeted advertisement. It's like, you know, if your friend likes this, then they like this type thing.
And like if you go to my Twitter account or the information security Twitter account, I just talked about Madware, which is actually, you see it more on mobile devices, but it's very, very pressing, very almost like the infomercial type ads on your phone.
Yeah, urgent.
Urgent apps. Yeah. There is even some of them that you make a phone call and there'll be a voice. The ad will actually play a sound in your earpiece.
Oh, wow.
So these things are real intrusive.
Very aggressive,
aggressive. I guess that's the word I'm looking for, is aggressive. Yeah. But that's the same thing. I mean, I wouldn't be happy with someone giving out my Facebook name because they want to vote for a football coach. If it was a true... authentic voting, you shouldn't need Facebook.
Well, and the fact that I've seen so many people do it that I am friends with, I figure I'm on their list already, but I haven't actually done it.
Yeah, and maybe they're being responsible with it. Who knows? It depends on the company, how responsible they want to be.
Yeah, but, you know, I always err on the side of caution, and it's even, you know, like on Twitter, there's things that, you know, if you want to see your follower account and things and like show me the number of retweets and the reach and things that you have, sign in here with your Twitter account. I don't usually do that because I think that's, you know, it could be a scam of some type and
some third party.
So, okay. So lots of things. Bad guys are certainly keeping busy out there, and we just have to keep our guard up all the time. And really, from what, you know, little I know about the crypto locker, the defense right now is you're going to have to go back to that last good backup that you have, because if it's if you have to reformat your hard drive, you have lost everything.
Wow.
And I believe it's only Windows, isn't it? Windows is the only
I've only seen it on Windows or heard of it being on Windows. And again, like you said, it reiterates that you need to back up your stuff regularly.
Right.
You need to back it up. You know, on campus, we've done a few things to prevent it so it doesn't happen to users' computers here on campus.
Right. And, you know, we can set those things that, you know, it asks you for an administrator password or whatever, you know, to double check. But, you know, even that, some people don't think sometimes. It's like, oh, I just want to install another program.
Right. And how we have a lot more control over the environment here than you would at home.
Right.
You know, we have different tools that can control the environment.
But I also say, you know, on the Mac side of things, I believe this came out in the last 2 weeks. Did you see the MacBook Airs, the SSD drives, they've got some failures in that, and that will lose some of your data.
Oh.
And SSD drive, I mean, you're in the same boat there. You're only, if an SSD drive fails, it's not like a spinning platter one that you have some recovery options.
It's gone.
It's usually gone in my experience that I've had. It's just a different technology out there, and Apple's replacing those for free under warranty.
I remember when the MacBook Pros first came out, they were having battery issues.
And I've had some FireWire issues with some of the old FireWire drives, so you just never know.
I think another thing recently, the whole thing with the Obamacare website and the conversations you're seeing on the news regularly and what's happening with those. And so I think that's just talking about how all of these things are so mainstream now and a part of our everyday life. And you know, it's just... it's just part of it. It's what we do, and it's everywhere. And we don't, you know, things like that that you used to be in tech sections of the news or, you know, innovations and that. Now it's everywhere.
Yeah. My technology pick of the week this week is the Twitter service and something new that they just provided this week, and I'm not sure that I like it, so maybe this will be a technology rant instead of a technology pick. But they just recently turned on what they call inline pictures in videos within your Twitter stream. So if you've been logged in the last couple of days, you have probably, you know, depending upon how many people you're following and things, you've probably been inundated with just, you know, pictures. Used to be you'd see a link, you know, they'd give a little short. Instagram, the little short URLs, and, you know, the YouTube videos and things like that. And if you wanted to see it, you would click on it and then it would display the picture. So now then they just made that automatic and turned that on. So the jury's still out. I don't know. For me, it just seems like it clutters up the Twitter page. And I don't know. I'm not liking it right now. And it's like, you know, what could go wrong, you know, automatically displaying pictures in your Twitter stream?
See, I don't see it.
You know, I have Tweetbot, and they've been doing pictures in line the whole time. So, like, when I heard it, I was like, that's nothing new.
Well, within the web link, and it's just, I'm not sure if it's just the Twitter URL shorteners. Yeah, I use TweetDeck, and I have the same thing. But there's different services like Instagram. Does Instagram automatically show up on yours? Because you use Instagram, don't you?
It doesn't mine. And YouTube doesn't either.
So like right here, Cindy, see my screen? Look at all those pictures.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's done that a lot, but it's just depending upon how many friends you have, you know, sending out the photos and things.
Well, on my iPad.
I'm following all the visual people.
Oh, here's
a video
one.
My iPad Mini's not doing it.
Like I said, it might be the different URLs. So they're experimenting again. I can see very quickly, you know, there might be an advertisement or something come up with more of the graphic visual.
Well, that's probably to prepare for their public.
Right.
Yeah, they're doing that IPO type thing. So they're preparing that.
Well, and these ones I just showed you on my phone, which no one else can see in the world, but it's from 8 days ago. So that's before it was even released.
Yeah, and TweetDeX has done that too for a little bit. But you know, for the website and things, but I know a lot of
embrace.
People.
Embrace change.
Yes, it will change.
That's
so
right.
So I guess I will have to get over it, but that's a change. I would like to find a setting in there if I could turn it off or not, but we'll leave that one for a future tech pick.
There you go.
You've also had to make some adjustments this coming month here.
Right.
You have to play taps here for iGoogle.
Yes. I can't abuse you too much for not wanting change because I'm going through the same thing. And that for some reason, iGoogle is gone. Or it's almost tomorrow, it's gone.
Monday, November 1st. Day. Yeah.
Anyway. Taking it away, I'm sad. Now that we know, we call this my home page because I wasn't even sure what to call the place where I start on the internet.
Or launching. Yeah, launching page.
There we
I like
go,
launching
launch page.
Page.
I like that. And that, but man, I'd gotten lazy and gotten so used to my Google that I'd customize it. Every once in a while, I'd change the theme and do something cutesy, but most of the time, it was just that ease of having everything at my fingertips that I wanted quickly. And so... They recommended some options that were out there and you know, available, and Yahoo and different, you know, companies had them as well. But being the lazy person I am and not wanting to learn something new, I guess, I went with one called IG Home that looks almost identical. And actually, I saw something where you can even export your settings.
Oh, that'd be nice.
And they'll pull it in. And that, so, you know, I've got my STL to my St. Louis newspaper feed on there, Tribune, the Library of Congress feed, all of those things are on there, weather, bookmarks, and that, but it's just...
So they kind of have the similar concept, where I don't know if they call them widgets or not.
Almost like tiles or widgets, yeah. And that, and you can set it up in two column, three column, whatever you want. And I never could get the calendar to look right, so I just took it away. But it's just those things that just when you hit home on your browser, it's that page you go to. And there are a couple of websites that I've got, you know, bookmarked that or would be easy enough to type in, but I just don't want to do that all the time.
Just another adjustment.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but I mean, the same thing with widgets or tiles, and you can put, you know, your Facebook or Twitter on there or whatever you want. There's all kinds of different things and that, but it's just, again, adjusting to something new. But I just, for the life of me, cannot figure out why they would do away with that. What was so hard about that, Tom?
Too many millions of users using it. That they were trying to concentrate and conglomerate their services, and I suspect it might have something to do with Google Plus, the G Plus, and all
right.
of that. You know, trying to get everybody back into that ecosystem. So
yeah, you know, Hangouts and the circles.
Yeah, to make it a little bit more integrated there. I don't know. I'm just guessing there. So
yeah, so I switched to this one, and over time I may look and see what else is out there, but.
Yeah.
So this was pretty easy to adjust to. Not a big difference at all. So if anybody else likes that,
we put a link out there. Okay. Okay, Mike, what do you have?
And speaking of embracing change, I have embraced change. I am almost going on a month without using paper.
All right.
And one of my biggest issues is I'm using my, as we talked before, I'm using my iPad mini and using Notability. And one of the big issues I had from going from paper and pen to my tablet was stylus.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like how Apple had styluses were spongy and
yep, I've got big. One right here that I don't like.
And, you know, and it, but I found a stylus I think I can live with, and it's called Lunatic. it's from a Kickstarter program. But it is a metal design, and the stylus point is that it's a pen/stylus, and actually it's a retractable pen, and where you would hold on to it, the rubberized part on normal pens for cushion is actually the stylus, and the tip of that part is a lot firmer than most of the styluses that you would use for an Apple-type touchscreen.
Yep.
And you prefer that?
I do, and I wish it was more fine point.
Mm-hmm.
I just grabbed it from you and writing here on my Surface in OneNote.
Yeah.
And you mean more? It's pretty fine point. You mean thicker or thinness or?
It's just, you know, I like to have that really... I know exactly where the tip of
it gives a little bit. It's like rubber on the end.
Yep.
And there's a little bit of give to it. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, and kind of, you know, I feel like I'm writing with the giant Crayola.
But it's well, that's what I feel like with this. I call the sausage stylus here.
Yeah. But this one's nice because it is stiffer tip to where when you're writing, it's not spongy and it doesn't move. Without actually writing anything.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, it's got a little bit of grip, which the others don't.
Right. And, you know, it's a little bit more expensive than most styluses, but it is also a pen, so which is nice if I go to a meeting and someone does hand me a sheet of paper with some type of printout that they did after I give them the evil eye for printing and giving me paper.
I know I made the mistake of doing some show notes and paper, and you gave me grief.
Yeah, I can actually write on it if I need to, or you know, sign-in sheet if you're at like a meeting or something.
The only thing, because I'm so used to the Surface Pro, where you can put your hand down for the hand blocking, you still can't, you know, with a capacitive touch. I don't think you can on your iPad Mini either. Can you? Can you put your hand?
No? But Notability has a you basically can apply like a screen with it, not like a physical screen, but in the app, you can slide up something that actually it turns off the capacitive touch for that area.
And because you're left-handed, I mean, it works that way as well.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, Notability has a left-hand and right-hand setting.
Do they make styluses that are fine tip like a pen?
They make one that you will always have the thickness. Yeah, because the capacitive touch can't recognize... something very fine.
Oh, okay.
It has to be a certain diameter for it to recognize it, that it's actually touching the screen.
Okay.
It's supposed to be your
finger. And you know, Cindy, you have the Surface Pro too.
Right.
That's an active digitizer, so it's actually kind of more of a hard, mm-hmm. and it's, to me, a more natural experience.
Now, I write on the Surface with my finger a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just, you know.
Yeah. And there's a company out there that makes another stylus, but that one was, I want to say, $60.
And how much was that when you say?
I think it's around 30 to 40.
That, you know, that's kind of regular price for like an active style.
But the other one has like a plastic disc that's capacitive.
And I have that.
And it has a tip point that's where actually it's going to write. So it looks like it's fine tip, but it's really not because it has a flat plastic.
Yeah, a joint. I can't remember the name.
It's clear, and so you can see through it.
I bought, that's like $25. I bought one of those, and I don't like it.
Yeah, you don't like it.
No. It, I worry about scratching, you know, too.
Oh, because it is just plastic.
Yeah, it's plastic. And, yeah. But
so this one's good. I mean, Lunatech's actually, they've had, this is their second Kickstarter program with the stylus, and I think that was about two to a year ago. But their original Kickstarter program was the watch band for the old iPod Nano that had the clock and the radio. Mm-hmm. I forget what, if that was fourth or fifth generation. I can't remember. It's really up to, like, you know, iPad Nano 20 or something.
Yeah, I lost track.
Or something like that. So, but it's nice because it is all, it is all metal. It's not plastic. And actually, the pen part's pretty decent too. It's a, it's a, it's a nice flowing pen.
It's kind of what you get used to, you know. I mean, you can adapt. You know, we're good at adapting and things. And I'm getting better with the sausage style. But like I said, I just got to remember to keep my hand up off the, because I've developed that habit with the Surface Pro. And it gives you much more control if you're doing artist work or things like that.
But yeah.
I'll have to borrow that and try that one out a little bit.
Maybe.
Let's see. Maybe. Maybe. Just for a couple minutes. Okay. So, thank you very much. That wraps it up for episode 158 of Tech Talk for Teachers. Show notes for this episode and archived episodes are available on the web at the EIU Instructional Technology Center website at eiu.edu/ITC. To leave a comment or suggestion, please send an email to techtalk@eiu.edu or leave a comment on the Tech Talk for Teachers blog. Until next time, this is Tom Grissom.
I'm Cindy Rich.
I'm Mike Joya.
Keep on learning.